Hi, I'm Suzanne Ross of the Raven Foundation. Welcome to Democracy, Violence, and the Risk of Tyranny with Professor Paul Dumochel. In this extraordinary election season, when democracy and peace seem to be under siege, the Raven Foundation is presenting a series of in-depth explorations of issues that you don't find covered in mainstream media. So this week, we're honored to discuss political violence and the risks of tyranny with Paul Dumochel, professor of philosophy at the Graduate School of Core Ethics and Frontier Sciences at Ritsumeikan University, Kyoto, Japan. Welcome, Paul, and thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
Welcome to our listeners as well. We hope that you enjoy the conversation and make comments and send us questions as they come up for you. Paul, I know you as a mimetic theoretician. We have come across each other at mimetic theory conferences over the years. And for those who are not familiar with mimetic theory, very simply, it's just a theory of human behavior that has applications across the social sciences. And you have been working with mimetic theory primarily in political philosophy and economics. Is that fair? Political science, economics, yeah. So we're thrilled to be able to talk with you about American politics right now. And we will be focusing a lot on your most recent book that's been translated into English, The Baron's Sacrifice. You've written about these topics in other places as well, but I'm sort of this is the book that I read and reread and reread to get ready for you. So just by way of introducing yourself, can you just tell us a little bit about how you first came across mimetic theory and how you use it in your research?
Well, actually, when I first came across mimetic theory, I was an undergraduate student. And it was the end of the summer, and I'd spent the summer in Canada, but I was studying in France, and I was taking a plane back to go to France, and I was just waiting a little, and just a few days before, I found this book called Violence in the Sacred, in French, and I read it, and I thought, wow, this is really great. And actually, the interesting thing is, a friend of mine, some months before, in France, had told me, because I was working on my master's degree in philosophy in France, and I wanted to do something on the notion of truth.
Mm.
And this friend of mine said to me, he was a Jesuit priest actually, he said, you know, when philosophers talk about truth, they always think about error. But there's also lying, which is the opposite of truth. There's a really good book on that. It's called Mensonge Romantique and Vérité Romanesque, which is the French version of novel, Deceit, Desire in the Novel, and which means romantic lie and novelistic truth. And where the notion of truth plays, where the relationship between truth and lie play a very important role. So, interestingly enough, I first read Violence and the Sacred, and then I read the other one.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, even though they were written in the opposite order.
Right. Well, 12 years difference, but to me it was a few months.
Right. So how did it influence what you were doing? I mean, your research, and how have you made use of it?
Well, there's a sense in which it's very hard for me to answer that question, because most people answer that question because they've already been working and doing things before they met mimetic theory. I was an undergraduate student a first year master's degree student. So I hadn't done anything. So how did it influence me is very hard to say, because it's been with me since I started working and writing and doing research.
Right.
So it's kind of like, it's hard to make the difference and say, this is it and this is outside of it.
Sure.
In a sense, because I'm a first generation, so to speak.
Right. It's just sort of woven into everything that you do. Yeah. Well, the book title here, The Barren Sacrifice, is obviously a use of a word that has a lot of cachet in hermetic theory circles, that term sacrifice. I know you wrote a whole book about the Barren Sacrifice, but can you sort of tell us, what does that title mean?
Well, the title means, really, it really is within mimetic theory. Mm-hmm. Girard argues that as time goes by after Christian revelation, then the traditional is not the right way, the sacrificial means of protection against violence become less and less efficient.
Mm-hmm.
So the idea of the barren sacrifice is precisely that. It's the idea of a sacrifice which is barren, which is not efficient, because traditionally in societies where the sacrifice is a working institution, it's not barren. Violent though it is, it does protect them against violence.
Yes.
Well, the idea is that, and if we look at the evolution of the modern state, what we see is that the state requires sacrifice from us all the time, but that this sacrifice becomes, as time goes by, less and less efficient, in the sense not of being more violent, but in the sense of being unable to protect us against violence.
Mm. Yes, and that theme runs through the book, and, you know, Yeah, it echoes. Sometimes I must admit to feeling a little bit overwhelmed, maybe pessimistic about some of the analysis, because it was so spot on and so predictive of disaster in many ways. You know, as you're saying that, as the sacrifice becomes barren, it seems like we keep doubling down and tripling down on it, however.
That also is a very Girardian idea. That's an idea Girard has. Like, the less these mechanisms work, the more violent they become.
Right.
Because we try to use them and reuse them and reuse them again to make them work.
Right.
I mean, we try is an excessive, is not the right term, because it's not a conscious thing, but it's an culturally ingrained behavior, might be the best way of saying it.
Yeah, right. No, it's right, because we don't really thinking about what we're doing. We're just doing it because it makes sense without thinking about it.
It's kind of like, it's evidence, just like, you know, you drop something, it falls.
Right.
Right. You know, it's evidence in that sense. Therefore, something which is never questioned, which we spontaneously do. And of course, we may question it afterwards because, oh, that's strange, it didn't fall, right? So it didn't work. But we don't question it at first.
No, we don't. Well, but that's what I like about having read your book. It does raise questions that we should be thinking about in the light of current events and what's happening, not just domestically, but globally. So, I mean, the book does cover, a broad range of relationships. And so it was just very captivating to me. But what I'd like to do is
the book does that, I'm very happy.
Oh, good. Good. I'd like to make you happy. No, it was really, I really love interviewing authors because it forces me not to just read it, but to read it, you know, like I have to really understand it. And so I appreciate the opportunity to have that exercise, which is great. So let's talk about this election that we're experiencing in the United States right now, the 2016 presidential election. And a lot of the way people are talking about this is in really sort of exaggerated terms, that this is an unprecedented election. Things are happening that we've never seen before. One of the things that that has been going on is just a lot of rancor and contempt and vitriol in the political rhetoric itself. And I was talking with a friend just last night about she has children just sort of coming of age, young adults. This is like their first election in which they're citizens, you know.
Yeah, sure.
And their experiences, she said, they want to vote. And I was like, well, that's great, because so many young people are getting turned off by this rancor and so forth. She says, but yeah, you know what? They're not voting for someone. They're voting against someone. Yeah. And it really is kind of sad. So and I don't know if that is normal. I mean, is that normal kind of politics? It doesn't feel normal to me. But I'm wondering what your reaction is. You're watching this as a political philosopher and as someone who's a Canadian living in Japan. So
somebody was far away in many ways. Right?
Yes, but gives you that bird's eye view. So I'm wondering, does this feel unprecedented from your view? And what are you seeing that's striking you as unusual or maybe scary?
Well, I don't know about unprecedented, because that all depends to how far back you want to go.
Mm.
Right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You go far back enough, you probably will find something which has a lot of resemblance, right?
Sure.
But as far as if we don't go far away, if we stay in the recent years, let's say 40 or 50 years, it is unprecedented, the level of violent rhetoric, let's put it like that, right?
Yeah.
Or behemoth rhetoric. I think that's something, it is not entirely unprecedented in the sense that I think if you look at how the political discussion has been going on in the United States for the last 5 or 6 years, outside of election period, right?
Mm-hmm.
The rhetoric has been going more and more violent, more and more vehement. Yeah. In other words, the whole Tea Party exercise was an exercise in saying, we are more vehement than you, the people of the Republican Party.
Yeah. Right?
So there was a kind of inflation of vehement politics, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I think what we see now in the election is the crest of the wave, which has been going in that direction for a long time.
Yeah, yeah, we've been on a trajectory, unfortunately.
Yeah, there's been a trajectory, and this trajectory has been, I mean, it's not just a question of political rhetoric, but it's a question of division, right?
Mm.
We are not like you. We are completely separate.
Mm.
I mean, within the discourse, it has been like that, right? You people are not even fit to be Americans, is the way nearly to say it, right?
Yes.
And that is very important, right? That is very important. Because
yeah.
that's very, I think, dangerous, right? Because
right.
The whole idea of democracy is the idea that we disagree, but we agree to disagree.
Yes.
Well, here, the rhetoric has had a tendency to be, we don't agree to disagree. We disagree, period.
Right. And there's no, and that,
therefore, there's no space for dialogue. Either we win and you lose, or you
mm-hmm.
win and we lose. But there's no space for saying, okay, you won, now let's work together.
It's the way you describe these relationships of solidarity and hostility and the having enemies against whom there's no restraint on violence are the ones with whom there's nothing in common and there's no hope for reconciliation. And
yeah,
the way you just...
Yeah, that's the danger of that rhetoric.
Yeah.
Because it still remains a rhetoric, but this rhetoric is very dangerous because it brings people to think, well, these things are normal and justified, right? Taking actions in relationship to this rhetoric is normal and justified. So it is, in that sense, I think it is unprecedented. And it reveals what appears from the outside anyway as a profound division within the American society.
Right.
And simultaneously, what a lot of people have been saying, and I think it's true, a profound disillusion with the political process.
Yeah.
In other words, that whether these people are Republicans or Democrats, it's all the same. They're all liars. They're all cheaters.
Right.
We don't have much choice between them.
Mm-hmm.
And the success of Sanders is a mirror image of the success of Trump.
Mm-hmm.
It's not to say that the two characters are mirror image, but I mean their popular success are mirror image of this affectation with the established political process. Right. And that, I think, is something which people in the political class, mm-hmm. use that term, should be quite careful about.
Mm-hmm.
Because this disaffection is very dangerous.
Yeah.
And it is not surprising also that analysts have been saying there's a lot of Sanders supporters who would be Trump voters. While it appears at first sight as the most bizarre thing, because these people are holding entirely different positions, but they think you have to get out of the normal process.
Yes. But then what? I mean, is the normal process so broken? And if it is, then I don't know. I'm trying to imagine, if you break it, what are you replacing it with? I guess I'm more conservative. I'd like to repair what we have, if that's possible, you know?
I think that is probably possible, but that will require, I mean, institution aid is not impossible, that's for sure.
Mm-hmm.
But I think to take the climate decisions which would do that is going to be very difficult, mm-hmm. because there'd be a lot of interest to post it.
Yeah.
I think that's one of the main problems. I mean, it is, if you look at certain aspects of the political process, like the Obama administration, which inherited the crisis, the financial crisis, you know, the result of financial crisis, put back into position exactly the same people who had been there before. That is, I mean, Obama represents something on a political scene which is quite different from the Bush administration, for sure. But at the same time, on the economic scene, he used the same people. So, is this because that's the way you think? Is this also because of another reason, which is simply that even though you're president of the United States, you can't do everything. You need allies.
Yeah.
And if you want to have, for example, health care, you're going to have to pay a price for it.
Yeah.
Politically. And that political price is going to be to put in back in power people which might not be the one you think are best, but that's the price to pay for the other thing. Mm. That's the way politics is made. And that's pretty hard to get out of there.
Yeah.
So that's why reforming the system is so difficult.
Well, it is the way you're describing. Of course, politics is the art of compromising, of give and take, of not holding positions that are, you know, lines in the sand kind of things. And
that democratic politics is like that. Yeah,
yeah, that's where we seem to have landed somehow. And it's interesting you started talking about truth, because it does seem to. It's a question of integrity, you know. People say, if I am a person of integrity, then I am true to my beliefs and values, which means I cannot compromise them. It's just, it's not politics. What is politics, Paul? How do you define politics when it's, let's say, when it's, what is its purpose and what does it look like when it's working well?
Well, I'm not sure we can define politics in general. In other words, I mean, when it's working well, maybe Carl Schmitt, which is not exactly a Democrat, not exactly a good guy, I think a pretty good definition of democracy, of politics, as being a friend-enemy relationship.
Yeah.
And so it is. Then the friend-enemy relationship can take some very different forms.
Huh.
And it can take, in a democratic society, it takes a form in which your enemy is not a complete enemy.
Yeah.
And it's a, you know, we're political enemy, but we can still be friends.
Right,
We can still share a lot of things, and we can still be friends together against somebody else. I mean, modern politics, as I think what Carl Schmitt has imagined, and I think as far as the description is concerned, he's probably right, is that the modern state was built by making friends out of every of its members, so to speak. Friends is a big word, but pacifying the inside by making an outside relationship of enmity.
Yes.
In other words, our enemies were outside.
Uh-huh.
And then what it means is that there is a relationship. This is not normative, this is just descriptive. There is a relationship between the level of internal conflicts and external conflicts. And this is the most evident thing in the history of politics and the most journalistic truth that, you know, when countries are falling apart and having a big conflict, they open a war somewhere else.
Yeah.
But and this goes back to the barren sacrifice, right? Does it work?
Mm-hmm. Well, for a little bit.
Yeah, but right now, if you look at the United States has been at war for how many years?
Yeah, 15, yeah.
And has it really succeeded in reducing the internal political conflict?
Not even close.
It doesn't seem to have worked very well at all.
Now, why? Is it because we're not all unified? I mean, the enemy doesn't... I don't know, it's a pretty awful enemy,
well,
terrorism and all of this.
Well, there's something else. Well, okay, if you want to talk about this war, terrorist attacks are terrible things, that's for sure. However, this is a highly asymmetrical war.
Yeah.
How many Americans, if you count soldiers and civilians, mm-hmm. have died of directly or indirectly of this war mm-hmm. in the last 15 years?
Mm-hmm.
Around 20,000 or something?
Yeah.
How many people outside of the United States to these exercises have died? It's more than 500,000.
Million. Yeah.
So that's highly asymmetrical war.
Mm-hmm.
So the conception of war of those where 500,000 people die and the conception of war of those where 20,000 die out of 300 million is somewhat different.
Yeah.
And that's to be expected.
Yeah.
So there is something very important about this asymmetry in violence, right?
Yes.
And in a way, these are just like colonial wars. Colonial wars were also asymmetrical wars.
Right.
You know, colonies, the British, the French, the Americans also, they would send soldiers who'd fight, but the fighting did not take place on national ground.
No, that was...
As far as France, England, or the United States were concerned, there was no war going on, except that once in a while, you learned about somebody who had died over there. But that was it. And it's still the same thing today, in many ways, except for the terrorist attack.
Yeah. I mean, I was very struck by your comments about the war... on terror, in the book, you say that the goal of the war on terror is not to reestablish peace in the hotspots, but to establish sanctuaries, protected spaces that are sheltered from the violence, and that that the violence is going to be tolerated. It just struck me as just a different. You know, those of us, you know, people who are fighting for peace and justice and an end to war, keep thinking that that's a goal, that makes sense, you know, that we want to end these terrible war zones that are all around the world. But you're saying that's not necessarily what the goal is right now.
Well, normatively, that would be a very good thing if
wouldn't
it happens,
it?
Right? But whether or not this is the aim of the agents, the political agents who are engaged in this exercise, is a completely different issue.
Mm.
First of all, the war on terror is a misnomer, right? It's not a war.
Yeah.
It's not a war in a tradition, in any of the traditional sense, which is also why it cannot have an end. It is more like a police operation.
Yeah.
So is there any end to police operation? Yes, to Operation 1, to Operation 2, to Operation 3. But, I mean, overall, it takes place all the time because there's always people killing other people, stealing other people. You always need police. So if war on terror is like a police operation, then it's the same thing. It just goes on. It just like flares up here, we stop it. Flares up there, we stop it. Or we don't, depending on our interest.
Yeah.
So in a way, the idea that we will defeat terrorism is a little bit strange, because it is as if, you know, the same way in which you say you will defeat crime, yes, you can reduce its number, but, you know, you cannot eradicate it.
Right, right.
And the fact that the other aspect of saying the goal is not to reestablish peace, well, look at what's happening in Syria. I mean, in Syria, United States, France, England, mm-hmm. at some point even Canada, but now they're out of it. A lot of Middle Eastern countries, the Arab Emirates, I believe, Saudi Arabia, Syria, Jordan, everybody was involved.
Yeah.
Now there's the Turks.
Right.
Right. And then there's also the Kurd, Peshmerga. And so, has anybody really, and the Russians also.
Don't forget, yes.
Not forget. So, has anybody really wanted to stop this war?
Right.
I don't think so. All these interventions were predicated upon one thing, not stopping the war, preventing this person or that person group from winning.
Yeah.
Prevent ISIS from winning. Preventing Assad from winning, preventing the Kurds from winning, preventing this or that mm-hmm. or that group mm-hmm. from winning. Not mm-hmm. stopping. Mm-hmm.
But so then the purpose then of keeping these sort of low-grade conflicts going on, you know, globally, if you will, is what? Is it just that we're expelling our violence outside our borders? Is this the sort of the safe zone to be violent? Or what is the, you know, benefit to, let's say, the United States as a political entity from having this going on?
Well, what's the benefit for the United States? I think the benefits from the United States has something to do with international relations. In other words, its position in international relations. What it's trying to do is it's trying to maintain its position as a major actor.
Yeah.
But at the same time, it doesn't want to go back to the Iraqi exercise. So it is, in a sense, stuck, you know, nowhere. Mm. And the other agents have all very particular interests. Well, Assad wants to win. Mm-hmm. The Turks don't want him to win, but they also do not want the Kurds to become more powerful.
Mm-hmm.
The Iranian also want to defend Assad.
Mm-hmm.
So all these people have different interests, but nobody has any particular interest that this should stop. Except, of course, the Syrian people who are the victims of this.
Yeah, the ones that we talk about, the ones who are completely powerless in this situation are just pawns, which is, as you're saying about the conduct of war and the barren sacrifice, the effect of waging these wars is having no impact domestically, as we're seeing the contention and conflict just seems to be getting worse, even, you know, the worse, and these conflicts unfortunately are not being really discussed in the campaigns at all. It's sort of like we're not at war at all.
Exactly. That's a big issue, because it's kind of like it's as if it didn't exist.
Yeah.
And actually, just to add one thing here, the issue is even, I would think, bigger in Europe. I mean, in the following way, if you look at it, statistic, if you look at the statistics, 80% of the refugees who arrive in Europe come from Syria, Iraq, Afghanistan, Kosovo, which means they all come from countries where Western powers have been actively, militarily active for the last 15 or 20 years.
Yeah.
And we have these politicians who are saying to us, all these terrible people who want our social security system, who want our money, who want our jobs, we've been bombing there for 20 years. Maybe it has a relationship, don't you think?
Yeah.
Nobody seems to make two and two. No, it doesn't get four. I'm sorry, it doesn't make four.
Well, that's because
an invisibility of our actions are invisible to us.
Yes. Yeah. And
we don't take them into account, and they're not a topic of discussion in the political domain, and that's a major problem.
It's huge, you also make this wonderful point that political violence isn't violence at all. I mean, what we do, our violence, sanctioned, legitimate, isn't like their violence. It's a different...
Yeah, exactly. We consider it as completely different.
As if it isn't violent. We can't even see, as you're saying, we're blind to our own violence, so how could we possibly assess its impact? But what one of the things, of course, to come back to the domestic scene, there is violence going on domestically that is in the news and being discussed a lot, which is the police violence and racism, the issues of racism. And as I was reading your book, there were a couple of places where I was writing current event topics in the margins, and when you were discussing indifference and the rise of indifference and the impact of indifference on our behaviors or how our behaviors create indifference, I don't know. You'll explain it. But I was thinking of this sort of, we were discussing this also a couple weeks ago with Adam's uncle, who's Robert Erickson, who's a professor of German history and Nazi Germany and the rise of Nazi Germany. And he was telling us that part of the problem with the rise of Hitler and the support of his racist policies was, there was indifference. It didn't affect me. Yeah. And so I'm wondering if, there's a certain way in which in the United States, we also say, we say, well, if you're poor or you're struggling or you're being arrested by the police, you must have done something to deserve it. And besides which, it's not my problem,
Yeah, I agree with you. I think that goes together very well. And actually, it relates to the previous question, to the invisibility of our own violence, of political violence. Yeah. I mean, one of the things about being a Canadian living in Japan is to have really a kind of Martian point of view on the problem in the United States.
Yeah.
Because, the gun culture of the United States is just like seen from Japan, just like, how strange. Why are these people like this? They're so bizarre. And one of the things which is striking, the racism is evident, right? That it is mostly black people who are killed by police. But it's not only.
Yeah.
It's not only. There's also white, Latino, statistically, it's very clear. But there is another issue which is very clear. What do they die from? From having a broken taillight. They die from not responding when they're asked to stop. They die from carrying a toy gun. Right. They die from nothing at all. Yeah. They don't die because they were shooting at policemen. They don't die because they were going around with machine guns killing people. No, they die from nothing at all. For transgression, maybe, you know, having a broken taillight. Yeah, sure, that is something you're not supposed to have. But isn't the penalty kind of like a little bit disproportionate?
Yeah.
Or for parking in the wrong place?
Mm-hmm.
Or for not responding immediately? I mean, what's going on? And the interesting thing is that until very recently, when the riots became too powerful, these people, grand juries, would say, nah, no problem. There's no problem.
They would in other words, yeah.
I mean, while in many other places, whether or not, you know, the policeman was justified because he was afraid for some reason, nonetheless, it wouldn't have been a no problem. It would have been a major thing, right? Because there is no reason for somebody to be killed because that person has a broken taillight.
Right.
That is just too disproportionate.
No,
so
yeah.
Whatever is going on, there is a failure of police action there.
Mm-hmm.
But in the United States, it is not viewed as a failure of police action. It is viewed as something, well, you're just supposed to obey when. And this goes with the side, the aspect of they must have done something wrong, therefore it's their fault.
Right.
And I don't care.
Yeah.
And these two things are, of course, a transfer of our violence. I think that is quite true.
Sure.
And there is another aspect which is, I think, fundamental. Why is it that American policemen are so easily brought to shoot people who are either unarmed or have done no major crime or anything? And why is it that people, most people, think that they are probably justified in doing that? Well, there is one variable which is really important. It's the amount of guns in the United States. You don't know if somebody has a gun.
No, you don't, yeah.
And of course, these policemen, they are rightfully thinking, who knows what this guy has? That's not it. I mean, that's not kind of like crazy on their part. That's, you know, it makes a lot of sense, especially when you have all the rhetoric about guns, and when you know the amount of guns that are going around, then of course these policemen would feel easily threatened.
Mm-hmm.
So these two things feed each other.
Yeah.
I mean, the gun culture and the number of people being killed by the police, they feed on each other.
Yeah, for sure. And,
I think that is important to, again, to relate those two things, not to just consider those two things as completely different.
Yeah. Right, because as you say, the police have reason to be concerned, but they're where these small infractions are eliciting this terrible response is in pockets of poverty and racial ghettos.
And it is all related to the fact that they think, well, you know, behind this little, what's hidden, right?
Behind
this small infraction, we don't know what there is, right?
Yeah, I suppose so. I mean, it's very, you know, sort of fits well with mimetic theory that, you know, victim categories are people who don't have defenders, who don't have people who will...
And therefore, victims are guilty.
Well, yeah, of course.
But the interesting thing is that we tend not to see them as good victims precisely because they're guilty.
Right, right. I know. It's very hard to have a conversation about these things. But I was very intrigued by your discussion of indifference in the sense that, you know, most of us bemoan indifference for just the reasons we're talking about, that we can't muster up enough care and concern for people who are suffering terrible abuses and violence. But you pointed out how these ties of solidarity also obligate you to be hostile, to do violence. And can you just explain that, you know, I don't want to call it the benefit of indifference, but it was it a benefit in a way when those ties were broken down?
Of course, there is a benefit, the fact that ties are broken down, because it allows, it liberates people from a certain duty of violence. which is simultaneously a duty of solidarity. So there is an aspect of it, which, and I think this aspect is really important. It has made the modern world possible. It has made, you know, a universal citizenship. It has made all sorts of things possible by breaking those relationships of solidarity, traditional relationships of solidarity. But simultaneously, it has made a certain type of indifference possible. Right. Because the question is, what do I owe this person? I don't owe him anything. Therefore, solidarity becomes elective, not an obligation. It becomes elective. I like you. I'll be solidary to you. But I don't like you, and I don't care whatever happens to you. I don't wish you any harm, but, you know, I'm not going to go out of my way to help you.
Right.
What has happened, if you look sociologically at the Western world in the past 100, 150 years, is that progressively the network of people with whom we felt solidarity has become smaller and smaller.
Mm.
It has become reduced to the immediate family, and even then, and good friends, and that's it.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, people talk of community, but I think most communities don't really exist anymore as communities. Right?
Not in that way, Yeah, it's sort of like I'm thinking of the opposite of this. These indifference is, when you think of gangs and the way gangs these days now are defined, you know, as these, there are these connections of solidarity and obligations of retaliation. And
but actually, gangs and, like, if you look at, actually, that's interesting. There's something interesting here. If you look at traditional, I would say, political parties and political movements, they were attempts to recreate relationships of solidarity. Clearly, the socialist and communist movements were attempts to recreate solidarity among all those workers who essentially were displaced persons.
Right.
All these people in the 19th century which came to work in factories, they essentially were displaced persons. You know, from their villages, they were out nowhere, they knew nobody. So it was a way to recreate community and solidarity between these people.
Right.
And, but now, there's only solidarity, if you look at the political discourse, go back to our first question, this animosity within the political discussion is only a solidarity of enmity.
Indeed. Yeah.
It is not a solidarity of friendship.
Mm-mm.
It is not, and that is very, the internal implosion, not explosion, but implosion of the Republican Party under the Trump effect is a very good, example of that. I mean, it shows that very, very clear. Like, it's a solidarity of enmity,
absolutely,
not a solidarity of... Because they're not solidary with him, but he's not solidary with them either.
No.
Right?
They're clearly using each other. I mean, the everyone's using...
Yeah, that's very clear. So that's no, it's not a... From a far distant point of view, it's very interesting. Of course, if you're an American citizen and it's a question of your next president, it might not be so distant, and you might not want to look at it exactly the same way, which is quite understandable. On the other hand, being the American president of the United States is a world job.
Yes.
I mean, it has effect on everybody everywhere in the world. Who is president in the United States?
Sure.
There's no problem with that. So it is an issue which also concerns us all.
Mm-hmm.
Not in the same way, but it does.
Yeah, no, we are, I certainly am always interested in what the perspective is coming from Europe or from Asia on what we're doing because we may not realize how important what we do is to the rest of the world, but the rest of the world certainly gets it. So I want to just talk about one more sort of current event thing that sort of ties in with this you know, as we're talking about solidarity and allegiances and so forth, one of the movements that has kind of come about in protesting police violence and racism has been this, I don't know if this has made international news, but a young African-American professional football player has decided to disrespect the flag and by taking a knee during the playing of the national anthem. And his name is Colin Kaepernick, I think is how you say it. And he wanted to express solidarity with the victims of police violence. And he's gotten a wide range of reactions, you know, from condemnation to imitation, you know, down to high school and middle school kids raising a fist or taking a knee to show solidarity with these victims. And just, I think a few days ago, Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg came out and said that he was being dumb and disrespectful. And a lot of people are outraged by his behavior and scandalized by it. I was just thinking about how you're discussing that the state has broken down all these ties of solidarity and demanding allegiance to it. And in the midst of this ritual of allegiance, this young man is daring to say there's another a group that has claims on my allegiance that maybe trumps the flag, you know?
Well, he is saying that another group has claim on his allegiance in some way. My feeling is this is enough. I mean, this has made it out, you know, outside, so to speak. My feeling is that one could say he is not disrespecting the flag for the following reason. He is actually protesting to the flag. That is not the same thing. He is taking the occasion of singing the American anthem to bring a message to all Americans.
Yes.
That's not quite the same thing as disrespecting.
Justice Ginsburg disagrees.
Yeah, but that's what it's all about. We don't all have the same
perspective, yeah.
Because what are the characteristics of this solidarity which he has, or which he expressed, is that it has exactly the same structure as the solidarity of the state. Mm. What I mean by that is that it is not a traditional form of solidarity. It is he expressed solidarity with every individual who is an African American. And does he get, how many is there of them? 40 million?
Yeah.
He doesn't know them all. He will never know them all.
No.
It is a very abstract solidarity.
Yeah.
Just like the solidarity which is typical of the state.
Mm.
I mean, you will never know all American citizens. Of course not, right? Nobody, you know, nor a Japanese will never know all Japanese or a Canadian all Canadians. But we're all supposed to have a solidarity. But it's an abstract solidarity in the sense that, or rather than abstract, it's an anonymous solidarity.
Yeah.
In the sense that it's not, you're my mother, I have solidarity for you. It's not a solidarity person. Which we can name the target. It's a solidarity which applies to every member of a certain class, which mm-hmm. is defined either by being Black American or by being American or Canadian or Japanese.
Mm-hmm.
So it is a solidarity of the same style in a way. And in a way, by protesting in front of the flag, he is protesting, I would say, the indifference and the silence of this issue in major American politics. This is an issue which should be discussed.
Yeah.
It is not. He is bringing it to the attention of people.
Right.
And he is, and that's why I say he is not, my reading is not that he's disrespecting the flag. My reading is that he's addressing the flag, which is not the same thing.
It's not, but yet many people feel scandalized by it.
And, sure.
You know, because how dare you? I don't I am not scandalized by it. I agree with your analysis and what are symbols of our nation for, if not to be in conversation with what they mean? I mean, what does it mean?
Yeah, in other words, what does it mean to stand up to the national anthem when the killing of people, of American citizens, is, how can I say, is being carried out as no problem?
Right. And this comes again, I mean, I want to, this will be the last thing we talk about, I hope, for this conversation. I might have to have you come back again. But it comes around to this whole idea of what happens when a state turns its power to use legitimate violence against its own citizens.
Well, I'm happy you're asking me this question, because I was going to say, can I say something?
Oh, good.
Which is precisely related to that. There is, right now, in American politics, a very evident actions by the state against American citizens, mm-hmm. whether it is terrorists, which we send drones to kill. It is really interesting. I mean, it is really important. Now, at the center of the Barron sacrifice, at the beginning, the idea is that the role of the state is supposed to protect its own citizens.
Mm-hmm.
And most massacres, genocides, and so on, have been committed by states against their own citizens.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what I want to say is this. It concerns the death penalty.
Mm.
People, when they discuss about the death penalty, they usually discuss about it in moral terms. Should we or should we not kill those people?
Right.
You know, is it legitimate for, or is it another murder? Is it, or they say, well, he killed someone, he deserves to be killed, right? Mm. As a moral.
Yeah.
So the discussion is framed morally. Interestingly enough, the discussion in Europe after the Second World War was not framed morally.
Hmm.
It was framed politically. The discussion to abolish death penalty is that it is a very, very bad idea politically to give to the state the right citizens. And from my point of view, when American people say they live in a free country, I always find it strange to live in a free country is to live in a country where the state has the right to kill its own citizens. That seems to be very, very strange.
Yeah.
And I think this moving to this type of non-legal political assassination or terrorist I mean, if the American states can assassinate people in the world because they think they're terrorists,
mm-hmm.
then what is different from American policemen killing people because they think they're bad guys? To me, it goes together. I mean, it goes together in the sense that there's kind of a pattern in all of this,
right?
Which we should think about.
Absolutely. Shoot. Well, so why do, you know, the state is, we give our allegiance to the state in return for this supposed protection, right?
Among other things, yeah.
Among other things. And when the state is unable to do that for us, does that...
It is unable to do that for us. It usually tries to find somebody to blame.
To blame. And is maybe this why we're all packing weapons here in the U.S.? Because we're afraid of that we've given the state too much power or something? What? Is there a connection?
I think that's, that's what I find as a joke. Because people say we hold to our guns because we're free. But if you let the state have the legal power to kill its citizens, it doesn't matter to how many guns you hold. It does not.
It doesn't. I'm with you.
So that's, and there's another thing which is quite interesting. I read a statistic I read recently. There are more guns than ever in the United States. But, interestingly enough, there are less people who have them.
Yeah, I saw that too. Interesting.
So what it means, that just like there is economic inequality, there is firepower inequality. Some people have a lot of guns.
Yeah.
And some people don't have any.
Yeah.
That's what it means.
What's going on?
Well, that's an interesting question. But I think it's a question we should think about, right?
Yes. Oh, my goodness. I feel like we just skimmed the surface of what we could be talking about. I kind of want to say, you know, what advice do you have for the average citizen here in the United States as we're trying to exercise our citizenship and go to the polls? Do you have any words of wisdom for us?
Usually when I'm asked this question, my answer is that I'm somebody who believes in the division of labor. What I mean by this is that the fact that I spend a lot of time making analysis of certain types of problems doesn't give me any particular authority to answer the question of what should be done.
Mm-hmm.
But I think, and that's what I meant at the beginning, I think if it allows people to look at things differently,
mm-hmm.
see them differently, that's important.
Yep.
And it's up to people then to do what they want and what they will. I mean, if we think about, you know, that a democratic system is a good one, right?
Yeah.
So the fact that I may have made an analysis which is interesting, I don't think allows me or gives me any authority to say, this is the answer, this is what you should do.
No, but it
and
does.
I also think that the type of qualities which are required to be a good politician are very different from the type of qualities which are required to be a social scientist, a philosophical analyst. It doesn't, you know, these two things, they complement each other.
Yes.
But one doesn't give the rights of the other.
That's no.
So that, in a sense, is my answer to your question.
Well, if I may rephrase it a little bit and say what you have, what I have gleaned from you, from reading you and speaking with you, is that it matters how we think about these things.
I think it does.
It
I agree.
Really does. And you know, I highly recommend The Barren Sacrifice and other books by you, because it does help us think about things and raise questions that often go unspoken, as we said from the beginning. We just often just acting without thinking.
I would just change it a very little bit, just to orient it in a slightly different way. I would be tempted to think to say it matters how we see these things.
Mm.
What I mean to say by this is that it's not a question so much of what we believe. In a sense, I believe this is the right thing to do, or this is the right thing to do, you know. But it is how we see them in a nearly, you know, like I can see my computer in front of me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the fact that I can see, that people can see the effect of the actions of the United
yes.
States in Syria and so on, I mean, that is seeing. That's not thinking.
No.
Then ask yourself questions.
Yes.
And that, I think, is fundamental.
That is.
And we don't, it tends, the way we see things tends to be presented to us by major media, which all repeat pretty much the same thing with a little bit of red or a little bit of green here, but pretty much it's the same thing.
Mm-hmm. It pretty much is. Well, I want to thank you for that. I want to thank you very much for figuring out what time zone you were, what time we were going to do this, because I know you're a day ahead of us and whatever. It's just
Thursday morning right now.
It's Thursday morning. It's Wednesday night here. It's Thursday morning where you are. And you gave me the perfect way to end the segment by saying thank you for being on the Raven Review with me. And our tagline is change your view, change the world. And I think you just set me up perfectly. So thank you very much, Paul. It was a pleasure.